content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue with the article we started last time, The Years of Robert Caro, by Chris Heath. Spending time with the legendary historian at his newly opened research archives, but not too much time. At 89, he's eager to get back to writing the final volume of his epic Lyndon Johnson biography. Robert Caro has spent most of his life asking questions of others, and he rather prefers it that way. He is gracious and fascinating company. And while he takes evident pride in the work that he's done, he's ambivalent about too much talking of himself. Toward the end of our final meeting, he'll mutter with wry good humor, "I never want to use a sentence with I in it again." Picking up where we left off, when not beset by distractions, Caro keeps to the same work process he has had for decades. He rises early, puts on a jacket and tie, and walks to his nearby office, picking up a croissant and coffee on the way. There, he still has 6 4-drawer cabinets and 1 2-drawer cabinet of Johnson research. According to his deal with the New York Historical, he explains, "They own everything I've written in any form, but with the proviso that I can keep it back until I'm done using it." He sits down to work in front of a lamp on which is pinned an index card bearing the words, "The only thing that matters is on the page." "It's something I believe," he says. "I'm a writer. When you get there in the morning, you shouldn't be thinking about anything else." Likewise, when he's set on a particular stretch of the book, he tries to do this every single day. "I don't take off days," he says. One of Caro's well-known habits is to record how many words he has written each day. In the Turn Every Page exhibition, you can see a marked-up calendar from the period when he was working on The Power Broker. Here's how the first half of April 1971 went. 1,200. 1,400, 200, 0, 1,000, 1,800, 0, sick, 1,200, 0, lazy, 1,000, 0, 1,400, lazy, 200, lazy, 1,400. Researching Caro's earliest journalism, I stumble upon a suggestive concordance. On July 3, 1961, the day after Ernest Hemingway's death, Caro wrote a powerful eulogy in Newsday that included the following sentence. At the end of each morning, he would carefully chalk the number of words written that day on a blackboard he kept for that purpose. One morning, when I visit Caro in the Central Park West apartment, where he and Ina have lived since 1990, I ask Caro whether Hemingway was the inspiration for his own work practice. "Yes," he says, very consciously. "There are a lot of other things that I took from him, daily routines in particular. Probably the most important one, and it is important in my writing, is I always leave when I know the next sentence. Another, every day you write first before you do anything else. That was a rule, and I followed that." "He was my idol," Caro says of Hemingway. Still, he didn't remember having written anything on that 1961 day. So I showed him some of the article, and he reads to himself its first paragraph. "The Ernest Hemingway who was a legend in his own lifetime was the bearded, barrel-chested central figure in a boisterous tapestry of gin and bananas and giant barlands. But the Ernest Hemingway who created the work that will be remembered in centuries to come was the man who, for 40 years, dragged himself out of bed at 5 a.m. to begin long mornings of loneliness before unyielding pads of yellow paper." "Well, no, that's," he considers, almost as though he's trying to suppress the smile coming to his lips. "That's not bad." At Princeton, Caro wrote his senior thesis on Hemingway. It was so long, 235 pages, that after Caro submitted it, the school capped the size of future submissions at 25,000 words. It was informally known as the Caro Rule. Recently, at a bar mitzvah, Caro sat next to a Princeton student and asked whether he'd done his thesis. He said, "Yeah, but I ran afoul of the Caro Rule." Caro tells me, "I don't know that he wasn't kidding me." I ask whether he remembers what he wrote about Hemingway back then. "Yeah," he replies, "but I'm ashamed of it because it stinks." In the 1970s, during a renegotiation with his editor and publisher, Gottlieb learned of this thesis and asked to see it. Caro never even handed anything over, because the night before he was going to do so, he dug out his thesis and began to read. "It stunk," he repeats. "It was so bad." The word sophomoric comes to mind. "I was so ashamed of it." Then and there, he started making corrections and improvements by hand on the manuscript. But after a few pages, he gave up and put it away. "It was stupid," he says. That's where Caro and I leave this subject until some time later, when, as I begin to prepare for my departure, he surprises me with a question. "You want to see my senior thesis?" "Of course I do." Behind him in the room where we've been talking is a wide-walled bookcase packed with the kind of smart mix of history and biography you might expect. He now fiddles with an inner edge of the bookcase until it swings open, revealing a second secret bookcase hidden behind it. This contrivance was designed by Ina, he tells me, based on something she saw at the historical English house of the architect John Sloane. Past Caro's body, I see various editions of his own books. He rummages a little and pulls out a thick manuscript, "Heading Out, A Study of the Development of Ernest Hemingway's Thought." Putting it down on a desk, he goes from page to page, pointing out his abortive corrections. "I'm looking to see what grade I got," he mutters, though the answer isn't evident. I ask him to indulge me and let me see the final sentences. With slight reluctance, he does so. They read, "Ernest Hemingway is a great literary craftsman and stylistic innovator, but he is also much more. His thoughtful handling of his mighty theme makes him a thinker who must be reckoned with in any consideration of the freedom of man." Caro sighs. "The whole idea of the thesis is wrong," he says. As he picks up the manuscript again, a thought strikes him. "So this has to go in the archives," he says. "I haven't gotten my mind around everything has to go yet, but everything has to go." There's another hidden space in the apartment, one I already know from the Turn Every Page documentary. As I'm finally leaving, I ask whether he'll show me. We walk to a corridor just outside the kitchen, where high on the wall are two small wooden doors. Behind them is what Caro calls the cubbyhole. He asks me to stretch up, "You're taller than me," and open the doors. Just inside, there's a messy mass of papers. Each day when Caro returns from the office, where he still writes with an electric typewriter, a Smith Corona Electra 210 to be precise, he brings home the carbon copies from the day's work, and they're placed up there. Every so often, the mass of paper is pushed back to make space for newer work. The space goes back about 6 feet, and he hasn't filled it yet. He's been doing this since shortly after they moved here, and nothing has ever been removed. So in this crawl space, there is an incremental sedimentary record laid down nearly over 35 years of what Robert Caro has been doing. I ask him whether this, too, will end up in the archive. "You know, I hadn't thought," he says. "They didn't ask for it, and I hadn't thought. I mean, yeah, they're entitled to everything." Sitting in the reading room of the New York Historical, eventually I feel obliged to point out the name on the wall over a locked door, Robert A. Caro Study Area. The man so commemorated visibly winces. I ask him what he thinks when he sees his name up there. "Like there must be some other Robert Caro," he replies. We talk some more about perhaps his most enduring theme, power. He's all too aware of the truisms. "I don't believe that power always corrupts," he says. "Power reveals." His work has shown over and over that as people fight their way to power, they often hide what they really think, who they really are. But once they have power, the truth, good or bad, ugly or admirable, inevitably reveals itself. "It seems to me like it's an idea that people don't understand," he says. Another thing people don't understand. It frustrates Caro that people might think he had devoted most of his life to writing about two men. He was never just writing about these men. So, he says of the ongoing series, each book is about Lyndon Johnson, but also about something else. These books are about a concatenation of people and events and the times in which they existed. They are about how things actually came to be. "My life has been a straight line," he says. "The article with the deaf guy, you're sent out just to do a straight thing, but you start talking to the guy, and you get caught up in his story, and you want to tell people that. You think that's important, that they understand him." This through line, I suggest, has continued ever since. The story of the people displaced by Moses' freeways, the story of the women of the Texas Hill Country, during Johnson's childhood. It comes from the same impulse, right? Exactly, he says. The same impulse. That's the right way to say it. I am always drawn to telling the story of a human being. A few weeks later, after his last meeting, I call Carol to check a few details. He's working, of course. In fact, he mentions it's been one of those mornings. I'm right in the process of throwing out what I wrote in the last couple of days. Today's glitch aside, I inquire, how is the book proceeding? That's a good question, he says. Well, I've written a lot. You want me to tell you what page? I would. 980, he says. The trouble is, it's going to be too long. It's going to be very, very long. That's all I can say. Reading through what he's written so far, he tells me he found himself sort of thrilled by the parts covering Johnson's legislative achievements in 1965. He now explains one very specific reason while writing about Johnson's life as president has taken so much longer than he ever imagined back when he started the project. Back then, he didn't know that he would eventually be able to listen to Johnson's telephone tapes. These days, there is a whole chasm of new material that a man like Robert Carroll could never possibly find a shortcut around. You're hearing Lyndon Johnson be president, he says. Because sometimes he would forget to turn off the taping, and you hear 4 or 5 hours of Lyndon, and he did so much of his business on the telephone. You hear him being president. One minute it's Vietnam, the next minute the British Prime Minister wants to shore up the pound, that Israel crosses the Suez Canal, then it's Vietnam again. I said, well, I'm not going to not use this if I did it right, and I'm not saying that I did, but if I did it right, people will get a view of what it's like inside the Oval Office, what it's like to be president of the United States. He takes a breath. So he concludes before resuming work on page 981. It took so much longer than I thought it was going to take. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section, Discovery, titled Diving for History by Jacqueline Kehoe. In the waterways of the Midwest, researchers uncover boats as old as the pyramids. Tamara Thompson was 24 feet underwater when she spotted it, the decaying end of a dugout canoe, a great white oak carved some 1,200 years ago. It was jutting out of a sandy ridge in Wisconsin's Lake Mendota, a body of water skirting Madison, the state capital, and she knew it was a remarkable find. What I did not discover was the breadth of the discovery. Thompson was diving that summer day in 2021 as a private citizen, chasing fish and collecting trash. More often, you'll find the maritime archaeologist in the Great Lakes, surveying deep water sites for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Lake Mendota had not been on the archaeologist's radar, and she certainly wasn't hunting for dugout canoes. Thompson usually looks for shipwrecks like 19th century freighters. It might seem remarkable that she recognized the find for what it was, dugout canoes, the world's oldest boat type found to date, or simply hollowed out logs. In 2018, however, Thompson had teamed up with Cecil Schroeder, an archaeologist with the University of Wisconsin-Madison, to help an undergraduate student catalog Wisconsin's extant dugout canoes. When the project began, historians believed 11 existed in collections across the state. Less than a year later, after scouring private collections, supper clubs, local museums, and more, the team had counted 34. Thompson's 2021 find spurred the two women to continue their hunt and take it public. Establishing the Wisconsin Dugout Canoe Survey Project, the pair and helpers have so far documented a full 79 dugout canoes, including 2 of the 10 oldest dugouts found in eastern North America, ranging between 4,000 and 5,000 years old. Wisconsin's dugout catalog sheds light on indigenous knowledge, habits of trade and travel, and even environmental adaptation. But the project also conjures a sense of magic in the familiar. To travel thousands of years back into history, look no further than Americans' urban lakes and rivers. The Madison area, known as the Djope in the Ho-Chunk language, was an indigenous metropolis before the arrival of Europeans, says Bill Quackenbush, tribal historic preservation officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation, one of Wisconsin's 11 federally recognized tribes. Djope was a richly interconnected society. There's this misconception that we had a temporary villages here and there, Quackenbush says, but Madison was one large living community. Carving dugout canoes would have been a community occasion, Quackenbush explains. Men would work multiple logs while families gathered, ate, and prepared for the coming season. Carving process with shells or stone tools could take weeks or even months. Once complete, a canoe would sit along the shoreline for the whole village to use. Nearly as vital as to thriving as fire, a working canoe meant open trade and shipping networks, fishing in deeper waters, and travel to faraway places. In winter, the Ho-Chunk would secure the vessels in shallow water to prevent them from drying out before spring. In fact, a map of the found dugouts shows us not just where the community lived, but how it moved and changed in place with the earth over millennia. Just 300 yards from where Thompson found the first canoe in Mendota, she later uncovered a cache of at least 10 canoes along an underwater ridge that geologists have identified as a previous, now lost shoreline, a beach in the savannas of ancient Djoupe. No one does this, says Amy Rose Bro, Wisconsin state archaeologist, referring to the relatively new approach of treating small urban waterways as potential archaeological sites. The only thing even comparable that I can think of is the mudskippers in London who walk up and down the Thames. Like those mudskippers, also known as mudlarks, who scour riverbanks for artifacts from London's past, Roman pottery, Victorian silverware, everyday citizens report dugout sightings across Wisconsin. The best specimens have wound up at historical societies and museums, including a Menominee canoe currently sitting at the Smithsonian Institution storage in Maryland. Some are hung high above supper club tables or auctioned off to private collectors. A few miraculously have managed to stay within their tribes, including the Ho-Chunk, the Menominee, and the Lac de Flambeau. It's the rumors of still submerged specimens, mostly anecdotes from hunters, fishers, and boaters, that make Thompson and Schroeder put in serious legwork. Receiving leads via a tip line, the women then go hunting themselves, diving, wading, or kayaking in Wisconsin's bogs and shallow lakes, and with little more to guide them than loose coordinates and a snorkel. The duo has thus far confirmed 79 of 112 reports across the state, and new ones are still popping up with regularity. Most of the finds are in surprisingly good condition. A few have even been accompanied by paddles or tools, like net sinkers and an adze, a wood-cutting implement similar to an axe. Some have turned out to be fragments, which is even more remarkable. The worse the specimen, the more likely it's deemed kindling and thrown on a fire. When they locate a dugout, Thompson and Schroeder start by collecting data the old-fashioned way. They fill notebooks with drawings, measurements, and lists of stylistic quirks from thwarts, structural cross pieces, and drag marks to charring and paint. Leaving all specimens in situ, Thompson then does photogrammetry using a GoPro camera. When working on above ground, she uses LIDAR, or light detection and ranging, a remote measuring sensor built into newer iPhones and iPads that, with a 3D scanning app, can create an instant 3D model for further study. Sometimes the GoPro works and sometimes the LiDAR works, says Thompson. Sometimes they're possessed by spirits and they don't want to be scanned at all. When possible, the duo also takes a sample of wood about the size of a matchstick, typically from the outer part of the canoe, for further analysis and dating. Ranging in age from 150 to nearly 5,000 years, varying in length from 7 to 36 feet, many canoes post-date the arrival of Europeans. Once in a while, though, they'll find a specimen that shares a timeline with Beowulf, the Phoenician alphabet, or even early math. Thompson has made discoveries at Lake Mendota that stand as some of the state's oldest. Carbon dating places her first find at 1,200 years old, and her second around 3,000 years old. The Mendota cache currently includes the survey's oldest, an elm dugout carbon dated at more than 4,500 years old. Beyond carbon dating, certain samples also undergo strontium isotope analysis, a means of measuring neutron variation within the same element to determine where the element originated. Wood type is identified via the Forest Products Laboratory, the National Research Laboratory of the United States Forest Service, conveniently down the street from Schroeder's office. Thompson and Schroeder have also sent a few samples to University of Wisconsin-Platteville for dendrochronology studies because tree ring data, which helps date the canoes, can also shed light on past climates. Using those four methods of analysis, the scientists frame their hypotheses. Across indigenous groups, for example, prevailing wisdom says the dugouts were carved from softwoods like pine and cypress. But a third of the survey's dugouts have turned out to be hardwoods, including oak, hickory, and elm. The latter is known for its tough interlocking grain and its modern reputation for requiring the use of power tools. We start to parse the data by time, explained Schroeder. It ends up telling a story of traditional ecological knowledge and cultural ingenuity. Wood type, even without tree ring data, provides clues to Wisconsin's past environments. Thousands of years ago, southern Wisconsin transitioned from a closed canopy oak forest to an oak savanna. In an open prairie, oaks, instead of growing straight and tall, branched too early for canoe making. The ancient Ho-Chunk, who also inhabited modern-day Illinois and elsewhere, then turned to the arrow-straight elm, despite its unyielding hardwood structure. Similar patterns follow the European contact. When settlers felled northern Wisconsin's white pine forests, tribes like the Menomi turned to trees such as hemlock and butternut. Variations aside, most dugouts look roughly the same to the untrained eye, which is striking since their makers had vastly different resources and tools. 3,000 years ago, the Ho-Chunk were carving in a world before agriculture and pottery. The design needed no improvement. As Quackenbush puts it, when something works, why change it? With the dugout buzz circulating around Lake Mendota, Thompson's discoveries have made international headlines. Madison's Ho-Chunk population has found an opportunity to reconnect with its past, Quackenbush says. In 2022, a group of Ho-Chunk youth and tribal members finished carving a fresh cottonwood canoe using traditional methods and then paddled it across the city's four lakes. In the summer of 2024, tribal members carved another and took it down the Mississippi River. Quackenbush, who works closely with the Wisconsin Historical Society, has taken up his own hunt, too. An expert in ground-penetrating radar, or GPR, he's leading his team in a search for more Lake Mendota artifacts, from canoes to campfire rings. We're always looking for layers of information that we can share even within our own tribal communities, he explains. We need that connection. We're wrapped up in the same fast pace of today. Thompson and Schroeder consider the local tribes and all the citizens involved in the project as partners in their research, a debt they acknowledge in every public talk they give. Other states seem to be taking inspiration from Wisconsin. Minnesota, Michigan, and others have started cataloging their own canoe archives, while the Society for American Archaeology devoted a symposium last year entirely to the humble dugout. Unlike many artifacts, canoes offer an inviting point of entry into the past, Rosebrow says. People have a lot of trouble connecting to spear points, she says, but people know canoes and they know lakes, and it's bracing to recognize that those depths might hold the ultimate sunken treasure. We'll move to a similarly subject in an article titled Sailing Against the Wind by Sonia Anderson, how Captain John Voss put his dugout canoe and himself to the ultimate test. In 1901, the Canadian mariner John Voss set sail from British Columbia in a modified dugout canoe. He was headed for Australia, seeking adventure, and the world record for the smallest vessel to circumnavigate the globe. Voss had found a sponsor and first mate in the thrill-seeking Canadian journalist Norman Luxton. Deciding a typical sealing schooner would be too easy, Voss purchased an indigenous whaling canoe carved by the Nuu-Cha-Nuth people on Vancouver Island. A 38-foot-long hollowed-out cedar trunk nicknamed the Dalikum, a Chinook word evoking community. He outfitted it with sails and decking, and on May 21, 1901, Voss and Luxton set out for the South Pacific. Their only map was a one-sheet chart of the Pacific, and they had no proper chronometer. Voss couldn't even swim. It took 58 claustrophobic days to reach Fiji, and the captain was taciturn, almost surly, Luxton later wrote in an account of the voyage. Soon after they reached Fiji, a depressed and fearful Luxton abandoned ship, but Voss simply found a new first mate and soldiered on. He had something about him, an aura of power and confidence, Luxton recalled. In the early 20th century, small vessels did not regularly sail very far offshore, says John M. McFarlane, curator emeritus of the Maritime Museum of British Columbia and co-author of a 2019 book about Voss's exploits. When Tulikum's voyage ended in London, the canoe was displayed at Earl's Court, where audiences marveled at its slim body, its lack of guardrails, and the very idea that a small crew could have survived more than 3 years in it. Voss had earned the reputation of a madman. Even so, as McFarlane and co-author Lynn J. Salmon wrote, he proved a practical and confident mariner, not part of the mainstream of society, but rather an individualist, a survivor. Move on to another article in the prologue section about origins. In the American culture, how Emile Frey whipped up a smooth dairy sensation by David Levine. The year was 1916, and Jacob Weasel, owner of the Monroe Cheese Company of Monroe, New York, had a problem. Some of the wheels of Swiss cheese made in his factory in Pennsylvania inevitably broke or were misshapen, leaving a plethora of bits and blocks of cheese that Weasel was desperate to salvage. He had this weight shipped back to Monroe, where the solution was concocted by one of his cheesemakers, a Caseia culture genius named Emile Frey. On his home stove in Monroe, Frey spent 2 years tinkering. His breakthrough came in 1918 when he devised a new way to mix the cheese pieces with whey, the leftover liquid from milk curds, while adding an ingenious emulsifier to blend the fats and water. Frey patented a key part of this process. The result was a cheese that, when melted, became a smooth, velvety sauce. Frey dubbed it Velveeta, and it became an instant hit. By 1923, Weasel had incorporated the Velveeta Cheese Company and was selling his new, sensationally satiny cheese to restaurants and hotels across America and Europe. As industrial agriculture rose in the 1920s, Big Cheese soon took over. Kraft Foods bought the Velveeta Company in 1927, and Borden absorbed the Monroe Cheese Company in 1929. Kraft soon changed the Velveeta recipe, though, crucially replacing real cheese, which has only three or four ingredients, with a paragraph of chemical elements that still graces the package today. In the 1930s and 40s, Kraft began marketing Velveeta successfully, if rather dubiously, as a health food and diet aid, and its low price and convenience, beloved by kids, shelf-stable, melts like a dream, charmed Americans' homemakers throughout the suburban 60s and beyond. The New York Times in 1976 declared Velveeta a worldwide favorite, although no country could vie with the U.S. for sheer consumption. In 1996, domestic sales hit an astonishing peak of 8.75 pounds for every American. Perhaps Velveeta's most remarkable moment was the devastating cheesepocalypse of 2014. Now, when Kraft announced a Velveeta shortage just ahead of the Super Bowl, "This is true, I'm going to die," one queso-loving fan tweeted, revealing a feverish love for a cheese product that, in fact, technically does not contain cheese. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.